Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, a petition to recall one of the most powerful Republicans fell short after initial review. Coming up, why questions surrounding the election still linger. Plus, we recap the state Senate's final scheduled session day of the year. And a new lawsuit could set up a do-over of a 2022 ruling that banned ballot drop boxes. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 15th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we're first going to start with the petition to recall Assembly Speaker Robin Foss. Now, there's, of course, a long saga to this, but we're going to start with the latest news. Of course, we knew this was going on. They've been trying to gather signatures for a very long time, but come by Monday, at first they said, well, we have enough signatures. Well, over, you know, about a 12-hour period, the Wisconsin Elections Commission reviewed those, and their initial review showed that a majority of those signatures turned in by them actually fell short. And this also was interesting because what they reviewed these signatures is that a lot of the signatures from his old district in which organizers were falling short of that number. Now, we knew long ago that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was saying that he called a lot of these signatures, this entire effort, into question. Now there's possible allegations of fraud, which we're going to get into, about stealing other people's identity to get these signatures on. But I think the big question going forward is about these certain districts, because that's what we need to know all along. We need some clarity on that. So now there's going to be still questions lingering for quite some time over which legislative boundaries, either Voss's old district or new district, and which one applies.
So remember, the Supreme Court in December threw out the maps we use in 2022, so they are unconstitutional and can't be used for a future election. The new map the governor signed a month ago has a provision that says does not take effect until this fall. So we're kind of in no man's land about what to use. But regardless of what lines you use, it looks like the petition are short. So let's kind of look at this big picture. You need about 6,800 valid signatures to trigger a recall. Looking at just Robin Voss's old district, the way it was constituted for 2022, they have about 5,000 and change. That is short of that number. In his new district, the newly configured 33rd, he's in the 63rd before, now he's in the 33rd, they're about 3,400, also short. Then there are some overlap there. Then there also are signatures from the new 63rd district, which is Mount Pleasant and Sturtevant, which is part of his old district. So which lines would you use? Don Millis, the chair of the Elections Commission, noted they asked the commission to, one, the agency staff do a more thorough review of these signatures, figure out exactly what the numbers are, and two, ask the Department of Justice to go to the Supreme Court and say, hey, what lines do we use? Because Millis said, in theory, the court could tell them they have to use the old district to gather the signatures and the new one for an election. Now, he's just throwing that out there to underscore like how confusing this could be for people. But the bottom line is, whatever lines you use, they appear short. Now, there's an option if you turn in a petition for recall or for nomination papers to rehabilitate signatures, okay? So you might have been missing something or there's a little piece off, you can go back and fix it. I don't know why they went from 10,700 that the petitioners they turned in to about 9,000 on the first review. We didn't get a thorough report of that. But we're hearing problems about possible fraud, so I don't know if they can even fix enough signatures if they're given the chance to get the mark they would need in any of those districts.
Right, and we know this is all about their growing frustration over Voss, who they believe didn't do enough to do an impossible act of overturn the 2020 election. He's also been constantly kind of nitpicked by former President Donald Trump. So this has been the same kind of coalition of voters that have been very frustrated for many, many years and continuously try to oust Voss. This is, once again, another unsuccessful effort. But in a sense, these individuals are not really going to go anywhere. This also goes into our next kind of story of what happened after they turned in these signatures. They fell short after initial review. Now the Racine County District Attorney is investigating several cases of possible identity theft by the Voss Recall Committee. Now DA Tricia Hansen urges anyone who believes their name that may appear fraudulently on a recall petition to look and review those signatures. It's actually on their website too, if you believe you're one of those individuals. You know, like I just said, JR, too, this is something that, despite another almost, you know, loss to the recall effort, they're still going to be adamant in trying to pursue to oust the speaker.
So, look, when this whole thing was filed back in January, the word in the Capitol for Republicans was these guys are not serious. They're not going to get close to the number they need. They're going to be collecting signatures in January and February. Remember, it was a cold snap when they actually filed the petitions.
That's right.
Granted, it got a little warmer, so they made it. But the point was, this is very hard to do, and these guys are not going to be able to get close to it. They did get the signatures, but there were problems, right? They got the number, the raw number, but there were problems. One thing I'm looking at is, in his old district, they collected more than 5,000, like 5,900 signatures, whatever it was. That's more signatures than votes Robin Voss got in the primary in 2022. Now, that raw number from the Elections Commission, the first review, could be high, because once you start taking out the ones that may be fraudulent or copied or whatever, it could come down. But that shows you there is some discontent there in that district. The question I keep getting from people this week is, okay, why does Robin Voss want to do this? He's the longest serving speaker in Wisconsin history. He's got all kinds of wins in that regard. He built the majority, the biggest majority that we've seen in the Republican caucus in decades. Mm-hmm. He barely survived a primary in 2022 by 260 votes. The theory is, if you could find somebody who's more of a mainstream Republican to run against him, who is well-funded, you could beat him in a primary. The problem is, this crowd who's like motivated by this stuff, they're not necessarily the mainstream, like the Main Street business type Republican. They're the conspiracy theorist wing Republican. That said, Robin Voss, if he runs again, which he keeps saying he will, faces the prospect of a primary challenge in August, because these guys aren't going away. The prospect of Donald Trump being the nominee, the top of the ticket, campaigning against him again, which he did 2 years ago. Though, again, does Trump want to cause problems in Wisconsin when he needs mm-hmm. it so badly? We'll see. All I'm getting at is, this is not a very appealing in some ways. But at the same time, if you're Robin Voss, and if you know Robin Voss, he's not going to allow the perception of these folks, people he does not view as real Republicans, but like these contemptible folks, have the satisfaction, real or perceived, of driving him out of office. So maybe he's so dug in, and he's such a political animal, saying, I'm not going anywhere because you guys are not going to push me out.
All right, let's move on to the next topic, which is recapping the state Senate's final scheduled session day on the floor, and that was on Tuesday. We're first going to start with the Senate acting to fire more of Governor Evers' appointees. On Tuesday, they fired two appointees from the UW Board of Regents. That's John W. Miller and Dana Wachs, both who previously served in the state legislature. Now, Senate Republicans also fired four of Evers' appointees to the Wisconsin Judicial Commission, which reviews complaints against judges and court commissioners. This is what was kind of the point of contention on the floor, and we saw most lawmakers talk about, is because this all ties back to Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz, who, of course, Republicans, you know, believe is way too liberal, that she's going to prejudge cases. So they're tying in people on this judicial commission to her to make a political point out of it. Let's hear from Republicans and Democrats on this issue on the floor.
These judicial hearings, the committee was not setting out to find out about the extensive professional experience, the long records of public service, including many who had served on the Judicial Commission for a long time. Instead, it was structured as a witch hunt, trying to force these appointees into basically making a prejudgment as to whether or not they would vote to censure Justice Protasiewicz. And they are being punished for that today because of the blind partisanship that has too long dominated this body.
Despite serving on the Judicial Council for years, many of the commissioners had no knowledge of the commission process. Others hid behind the commission's confidentiality or used technicalities and questionable methodology to justify decisions they made or will make. The Judicial Commission must remain neutral, above partisanship, and enforce the law by following the laws without bias. Even if the Wisconsin Supreme Court has taken a hard turn into politics and partisanship instead of law, the Judicial Commission must not.
We've talked about kind of the magnitude of these numbers, too, and just comparing it to when Evers was in office and previous administrations when it comes to firing appointees. Once again, we're going to put that into perspective. Just this legislative session, 22 executive branch appointees and, you know, previously during Evers' administration. And then looking back at the past from 1981 to 2019, there was only four that were rejected by the Senate. So it still sets a precedent, even though Republicans have long maintained, you know, if you got political ties, we're not going to confirm you.
So here's the thing. Most of the time, we don't get explanation on the floor about why they're being rejected. With the Judicial Commission, Democrats are adamant it's about Janet Protasiewicz because the commission rejected complaints that were filed about what she said during the 2023 campaign, calling the maps rigged, hearing that case and voting to overturn the GOP maps. Van Wongard from Racine Republican was the one member who stood up and said, no, it's not about that. It's about that these guys don't know what a walking quorum is. They hid behind the secrecy of the commission to not answer questions, that there are problems, they're partisans. During the August public hearing, though, and several of them, it was all theoreticals of when should a justice step aside? When do you cross a line? Like, they were very adamant about that. So there's that piece. Okay, well, so they go back and forth about that. The regents, John Miller, Dem donor, businessman, Dana Walks, former state lawmaker, nobody said anything. But it's clear they had the gall to vote against the DEI package that Robin Voss negotiated with UW leaders. John Miller said during the whole process, it's less about the effort here than it is about the precedent. They're probably going to come back again and again and ask for more money or hold back money trying to enforce changes that they can't do otherwise. He was worried about that. They're nothing illegal, nothing ethical. They just didn't agree on about DEI. There's a woman who was on the Domestic Abuse Council, appointed by the governor, confirmed 31-0 for an earlier term 2 years ago, approved by a committee 5-0 just a few months ago. She was rejected. Her sin, apparently, is that the council has gotten too, quote-unquote, radical, according to Republicans. There is a report on domestic abuse talk about white privilege. That is a no-no in Republican circles these days, all right? Another guy on the Deferred Compensation Board, what did he do wrong? He was the WEAC president 2 decades ago. And this board handles compensation cases with retired educators. He's too partisan. So again, we've lowered the bar in Wisconsin from, okay, like I went back and looked. There was a guy who was rejected for an appointment. He had made racist comments, homophobic comments, like back years ago, like right before his rejection. Okay, there's something different. We're not talking about Dana Walks and John Miller doing anything other than disagreeing with Republicans. But Republicans feel like the governor is sending them two partisan of appointees who aren't there to for the good of Wisconsin, but to push an agenda. And they are pushing back against that hard. Now, looking forward, how do you find people to fill these spots if they're worrying about that? And by the way, the governor is not taking the sitting down. If you look at the Judicial Commission, okay, he appointed a former Assembly Democratic Minority Assistant Minority Leader to the body. So, okay, you don't like partisans. Here's this partisan. Another one he appointed is Annalise Eicher, who was on One Wisconsin Now. Basically was the Democratic Opposition Research Group in Wisconsin for years. Mm-hmm. She has a partisan background and then some.
Right.
So the governor is saying, look, we're going to give it right back to you. And then, by the way, there is only one member of the state Senate who was ever the minority at all in the Senate. That's Rob Coles. This is 1987. He's also the only person in the Senate caucus who has been the minority when there was a Republican governor in a Democratic-controlled Senate. Way back when, I hate sounding like I'm old, but there used to be like this detente, like, we're not going to mess with you because you can mess with us when the roles are reversed. For 13 years almost, Republicans have had control of this chamber. They don't know the repercussions of this behavior, whether it's right or wrong, what they're doing. Democrats aren't going to forget. There's a path with these new maps to have a Republican governor and a Democratic Senate. These guys are going to remember what happened with these appointees. And oh, by the way, if a member of the Senate who might get an appointment by a Republican governor, which would happen is boost his or her pension significantly, they're not going to be real receptive to that person's appointment, possibly, if they have a memory and they hold grudges, which kind of happens in politics
once in a while. It does, and that leads on kind of to my next point, because I made some calls. You know, this is, once again, we've talked about a lot of these appointments being fired. And, you know, some Republican, you know, conservatives are basically telling me, it's all about power. Mm-hmm. You know, they feel that, of course, they send the governor bills, he vetoes them. It's all about messaging. But this is one thing that they like to hold on to. Also with the Joint Finance Committee, right? They pass a budget, there's funding there, like with PFAS. Well, I'm not going to like it, so I'm going to hold on to this power and try to tweak it how I can. So that's how they try to see themselves as still having just what they can do in the legislature. Yeah. And it's just all about politics, like you mentioned. Let's move on to also kind of the meat that was voted on Tuesday. We're going to highlight some of the bills and some of the controversial ones and other things that they didn't take up that both sides of the aisle would have liked to see on the floor. First, let's start off with them passing a legislation that would ban transgender athletes from competing in women's sports, a bill that Governor Evers has vowed to veto. They also approved a constitutional amendment that would bar governors from spending federal money without legislative approval. Of course, that comes out of the pandemic. The governor had lots of money from the administration. He had full authority of how to spend it. He's still spending it. It's almost gone. They don't like that. They want to have a say in it. Now, however, this is kind of the storyline we want to talk about. Republicans and Democrats were frustrated about two certain bills that they didn't take up. We've talked about this before, about the bill that let clerks process absentee ballots the day before an election, not count them, open them, get ready them for to feed in the machine on Tuesday. The other bill was the heavy lobbied transmission line proposal. We thought maybe there could be surprises, right? They have this authority where they can pull a bill out of committee if you get at least two-thirds of vote on the floor. Didn't happen. Democrats almost seemed like they tried to do something at the last minute, but session abruptly ended. And a lot of us, I think, were surprised that it ended so quickly at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I can't say I've ever seen the last day, well, the expected last day of session end
Correct.
That way. So right of first refusal would allow existing transmission companies that have existing transmission lines and infrastructure the first shot to build new high voltage lines. We're expecting Wisconsin about $2 billion in work in the coming years. It's a lot of money. And in this discussion, the proponents have argued that this bill, right of first refusal, would give certainty to the process and help speed up the construction. The opponents say you're killing competition, which means you're going to drive up prices. There was an idea going into the last session day that somehow Devin Lemme, who was a big proponent of this bill, this is one of his pet projects, that he would try and find a way to go around this block of his members that are opposed to it to get on the floor. The idea was he could get some people who are kind of, quote, team players who support him as a leader to vote to put the bill on the floor, but then they'd vote against the merits, but the Democrats would help him pass the bill. Need 17 votes to pass them, right? That rule of 17 again. You don't want to go against your caucus where you need Democratic votes to pass something. It burns bridges. Well, Devin did it with shared revenue back in the summer, the Brewer's bill, and alcohol in the fall. Would he do it again? And he didn't even try, it looks like, at least not on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
From what I can pick up, there were some calls that were made around the caucus to say, hey, how would you feel this happened? It was not good feedback. It would cause a problem. So Dianne Hesselbein, who's a minority leader, head of the Democratic caucus, I asked her, did they even ask you what numbers you had if they did a polling motion, how many votes you'd have? She said no, and if they did, we'd have to have, you know, a caucus to figure it out. We haven't really talked about it. She said, I even went and asked, like, hey, do you need a head count? And I was told no. So there was not a real plan going the final day, the final day, to do this. For Lemahieu, there are a couple of things that they go. I have not seen in all my years a more dysfunctional leadership team than Devin Lemahieu and Kish Kapinga, majority in the Senate president. They aren't on the same page in a lot of bills. Remember the alcohol bill that Lemahieu was a co-author of? Kapinga blocked it, essentially. Lemahieu attached the entire overhaul, the three-tiered system, to a different alcohol bill. Kapinga is a procedural trying to kill that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lemahieu led a vote to override the Senate president of his own party. I've never seen that happen. So now this fall, we're going to have an election, different map. What's going to happen with leadership? Lemahieu, there are conservatives who aren't happy with him. Will they make a run at him, trying to dethrone him as the leader? Kapinga has got people who are unhappy with him. Will somebody make a run at him and try and change that dynamic? It's going to be fascinating to watch that. And, oh, by the way, these elections could change the caucus. You have this conservative wing, kind of really conservative wing, that's able to block things at times because of that rule of 17. They get really unhappy when you go against rule of 17 because that rule emboldens them hold things up. Okay, will there be more of them or less of them after November? Then what's your math for the leadership election? Let's say it's 22 to 11 right now with one vacancy, or sorry, 10 with one vacancy. Let's say Republicans have 19 that come back. You need 10 votes to get a leader. What's that 10 going to look like? That's the real question. What's that 10 look like?
It's been a little dysfunctional, for sure, to say the least. All right, we're going to move on to our next topic, which is dealing with absentee ballot drop boxes. Why? Because there's likely going to be a do-over of that lawsuit, which is from 2022. They were ruled unconstitutional outside of beyond election clerk's offices. So, you know, by your public library, by the fire station, those were deemed illegal. Well, now the state Supreme Court has agreed to revisit the issue as Democrats are looking to put them back in place for the November election. Now, conservative justices have, of course, blasted this decision as politically motivated. Well, why? I think most of us know, because the court just flipped to liberals' control. And this was an issue, though, JR, that is no surprise, given that these were the things that we talked about plenty of times, abortion, election law, you know, things that Democrats have long wanted to revisit once they got control of the court.
Conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley says the court's already made up its mind, the liberal majority has. They're going to reverse the decision from 2022, allow drop boxes. Probably a good bet. They wouldn't take the case up again if they didn't want to try and revisit it. And they were sharply divided 2 years ago. The liberals, who are the minority now, have a different view about drop boxes. Okay, so they also fast-tracked this. They have arguments in mid-May, so they should have a decision in time for the fall primary and general election. It's also one of several lawsuits we think will get before the court. Don't forget, there are lawsuits working their way through the courts right now about the witness state information on the absentee ballot envelope. What's the standard for an address, for example? What about the just things like that? They're going to come up that do you need a witness, period, is in the courts right now. Mm-hmm. So all these things we've talked about, this court is going to dictate how this election is run. If Donald Trump loses Wisconsin and things are changed back to where they were in 2020, it'll add fuel to the fire for the conspiracy theorists about, well, he lost because it was rigged, quote unquote. What if Trump wins with these rules going back to 2020 standards?
That's so interesting, right? Yep. I mean, I think there's a lot of us that think that way, too. I think the other thing I'm watching for is how many people are still voting absentee, right? I mean, 2020, of course, pandemic, not a lot of people leaving their house, didn't feel comfortable going to stand in line around, you know, hundreds of people going into a polling place. Numbers have dwindled a little bit. Is it still attractive more towards Democrats? Absolutely. I mean, not having to stand and wait in line sounds pretty appealing to most people. But how many people are going to be using these ballot drop boxes if they are put back in place for the fall election? That's what I think something I'm going to be looking for.
Just went like this morning. It was 60% of ballots cast in 2020 in the presidential race were absentee. In 2022, it was 30%. So it tells you we're getting back to our normal kind of process for voting. So it might not be as big as an impact. But again, if Trump were to be the nominee and to lose Wisconsin, mm-hmm. it would be fodder to say, well, it was stolen from him again.
All right. Let's move on to another visit from the Biden campaign. And this time itself was the president who came back for now. This is the second visit of the year. He was in Superior in January touting infrastructure. Well, he came back. He was in Milwaukee also touting infrastructure. So this was part of his $3.3 billion infrastructure plan, which includes $36 million to help rebuild Milwaukee's 6th Street. Now, the grant is from the Biden administration's Reconnecting Communities program, and it will help rebuild roughly about a 2.6-mile stretch of 6th Street between North and National Avenues. Now, for folks who are not familiar with this, this was a big project back in the day that really kind of put a divide in the city. And that's what kind of the president highlighted, too, is that getting to and from, this was to build an interstate. So they widened the streets. A lot of houses were teared down. And it kind of just separated the Black community and the Hispanic community. And just getting across 6th Street is extremely dangerous. There's not a lot of walkways. It's not very bike-friendly right now, pedestrians. So these are all the kind of the renovations that are going to transform this area. And looking at it, you know, Biden came here, of course, to Milwaukee, always usually for a reason, right? I mean, yes, it was to tout this money, but, you know, Milwaukee sometimes can just be a toss-up. And he's also trying, we saw visits from the First Lady, from the VP in the Waukesha, the Wow County areas to try to appeal to suburban moms. So they've been barnstorming the state quite a bit, JR. Of course, we know former President Donald Trump will be here at some point, but Wisconsin has a later primary, so that could be a factor, too. But let's just take a listen, too, from the president himself kind of touting about this 6th Street renovation.
These are life-changing improvements. They're also going to make it easy for historic Black communities in the North and Latino communities in the South to access jobs, school, and entertainment. Just this week, Donald Trump said cuts to Social Security and Medicare are on the table. When asked if he changed his position, he said, quote, "There's a lot we can do in terms of cutting. Tremendous amount of things we can do," end of quote. I want to assure you, I will never allow it to happen.
All right, let's move on to our next topic, which is TikTok. I don't even have it, but boy, is it in the news these days. Why? Because there's this big concern about the company ByteDance that owns it. They're in China. They have full control over it. There's a lot of people concerned about them having control over this app, which a lot of people, even my age and your age, JR, I would say, a lot of people are on it. I'm not.
Ow. Ow.
But of course, this was called a TikTok ban. We've long talked about it. It's been Congressman Mike Gallagher's kind of baby in a way. And we just want to give a quick roll call vote of how it went down. As you look at your slide, all the yeses are from Republicans. The other side, Democrats, Representative Mark Pocan, Congresswoman Gwen Moore on a nose. But what I think is interesting about this dynamic is that Senator Tammy Baldwin supports this. President Biden said if they get it to his desk, he'll sign it. Oh, by the way, even though he supports it, he has a TikTok and does TikTok on it. So that's kind of some of the Republicans have been bashing him for that. But it's just something interesting to watch going forward because there's a lot of concern right now. There's a lot of influencers that make their living off of this. You know, I know I'm only on Instagram, but there's kind of these similar things that people can, you know, help you sell things, build their business, those kind of concerns. So interesting to see when and if the Senate takes the bill up, because that's what's going to be the big question mark, because they like to take their time, mm-hmm. just like kind of here in Wisconsin. Assembly passes a lot of bills. Senate likes to go a little slower. All right, let's get to stock picks this week. And rising is AFP Wisconsin, Americans for Prosperity, because they had a big role in killing what was called the Roper bill, which you talked about.
There was a coalition of groups opposed to it. They were kind of tip of the spear. And really, in talking to people, it seems like it was an easier argument to make to Republicans that if you kill competition, you'll drive up prices. That's easy to comprehend. The argument from proponents of actually if you pass this bill, you create certainty, which will help, that's a harder, more complicated argument to make. And so AFP had the high ground essentially message-wise. Now, again, they weren't by any means alone in this, but they were kind of driving their tip of that spear a little bit in doing this. And look, Roper's not dead. It'll come back probably next session. There'll be another attempt at it. But it was a victory of these guys over the utilities who had a lot of big players, and a lot of money lobbying that bill.
And mixed this week is Senator Joan Bollweg because of her kind of a mixed bag of votes on the floor.
So Joan Bollweg, you're not going to question her conservative credentials. She's a rock-solid Republican vote. She did vote break with the party in the transgender athletes bill. This is like looking at polling. It's quite popular with the public overall. It is almost like built in the GOP base that, you know, that's orthodoxy. Bollweg, though, has got a new district. She was drawn into a district with John Jagler. Her district, the 14th, became a Democratic one, like 54% Dem. She's going to move into that district and run for it. So numerically, it's her district. Geographically, it's not really what she represented before. She has to introduce herself to a whole bunch of voters, and she's got to, you know, go run a primary. This may not be something that you'd go, this is great for you in a primary. You might think on the surface, well, this would be actually better for you in the general election because it's a Democratic district. This is not about the election for Joan. Go back to last session. She also voted against this bill in committee, this one and one employing college sports. She has a disagreement with it. She was the chair of a speaker's task force on mental health when she was in the assembly. She told me 2 years ago that she had an issue with this because of what she's seen when it comes to suicide attempts for kids who are LGBTQ+. Like, she saw this up close with this task force and said, this is not where I want to go. And she stood her ground and voted against this. Is it going to cause her a problem? Would it generate a primary vote, our challenger? I don't know. Is it going to help her in that race in the 14th? Probably not, because it won't be overshadowed by other things she's done. But it just goes to show you sometimes people vote for things in principle in this building, not because of politics.
They do. All right. Falling this week is Catholic Charity because of a state Supreme Court ruling this week.
So it's not just who's doing it, it's why you do it. So look, there's a provision in state law that says if you are a religious organization doing religious things, you are exempt from the state's unemployment system. The Diocese of Superior has this thing, Catholic Charities Incorporated, has four sub-entities. That are doing work with people who have mental health challenges, who are mentally disabled, those kinds of things, providing job services, helping them job placements. They argued we shouldn't have to pay unemployment tax because we are a religious organization. The liberal Supreme Court majority said 4-3 ruling, well, yeah, you're owned by the diocese, but what you're doing is not religious. You're not out there preaching religion, giving religious materials to people. You are doing basic job services type stuff. You don't qualify. The conservative majority said this is all wrong. They're misreading the statute. I would watch, though, for an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Remember, if the state Supreme Court does something that people don't like, they go to the U.S. Supreme Court. You can raise a federal First Amendment case that they're misreading the federal law and the First Amendment, that could be what goes next.
Yeah, it might not be the end of that. All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.